I'm Robin Lustig in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The First Amendment protects reporters from being compelled to name their sources. Right? No, wrong. It guarantees the freedom of the press, but it says nothing about reporters not having exactly the same responsibilities as anyone else to assist in the administration of justice. In some states, there is protection for reporters at state level, but it doesn't apply at the federal level. So where does that leave reporters like Matthew Cooper of Time magazine, who's being threatened with jail unless he reveals who told him that the wife of a former US ambassador who was asked to investigate Iraq's acquisition of nuclear weapons material was herself an operative in the CIA. Reporters say that unless they protect their sources, soon they won't have any. And then how would the public discover what mistakes are being made in government? On the other hand, if reporters have evidence that could lead to the arrest and conviction of a felon, should they really be able to keep that information to themselves? Rights, responsibilities, freedom of the press and the administration of justice. Where do you draw the line? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, we're going to be talking to several guests this hour, but we start with Floyd Abrams, who's Matthew Cooper's attorney. We spoke with him earlier when he outlined Cooper's case.
What he's arguing is that under the First Amendment of the Constitution, journalists are protected from having to reveal confidential sources unless the government can meet a quite heavy burden of showing that they really need the information enormously and that they can't get it elsewhere. And based upon that, we'll be urging the appeals court to set aside the finding of contempt of court.
Do you, though, as a lawyer who specializes in these matters, accept that there is a balance that needs to be struck between a free press and the administration of justice?
Yes, there's a balance that needs to be struck, and the legal test that we're seeking to persuade the court to adopt is one which itself reflects a balance. That said, however, there are many journalists who believe that they simply cannot and will not compromise their confidential sources, whatever legal tests might be adopted. Therefore, for them, if they lose their cases, that they are often prepared to go to jail to defend the secrecy of their sources and the sanctity of their promises.
And do you believe that the law ought to enable a reporter to do that, even if, by refusing to disclose the identity of a source, the result could be that a felon remains at large and is unconvicted?
I think that a reporter generally ought to be able to do that, because I think that the consequences of not allowing journalists to do that are worse than the consequences of an occasional, and it would only be very, very occasional, guilty person going free. I mean, every time we have a so-called privilege in the law, what it means is that somebody who knows something relevant is not revealing it, and that relevant information could be of use to the truth-finding process of a court. For example, I know who the sources are. I know them because my client has told me to help us work out the client's defense, but no one would think of calling me as a witness because it's generally accepted that there is an attorney-client privilege and that therefore, even though it might be helpful to have the information, the lawyer will not be put on the stand. The question in cases like these is whether journalists also ought to have that sort of privilege, allowing the communicative process to remain open between journalists and their sources.
How important do you believe that this specific case could turn out to be in resolving these issues?
It could be quite important because, although there have been a number of cases in this area, they have rarely, if ever, arisen in a context in which the reporting involved related to matters of national import, and on the other side, in which the government was claiming that the reason it needed the information was because it was engaged in a so-called leak investigation, which itself could lead, at least in theory, to criminal charges being brought. So it could well be a very important ruling, one which could have some very significant impact in the future.
So is Matthew Cooper's case then receiving the backing of other media organizations?
Yes, it is. There will be a friend of the court brief submitted in the Court of Appeals by a wide range of other media organizations who have been calling over the past few days, setting forth a very strongly felt view by media entities around the country, in print, on television, on radio, magazines, that some level, at least, of legal protection ought to be available.
The First Amendment attorney, Floyd Abrahams, who's representing Matthew Cooper of Time magazine. Well, let me bring in two of my guests this hour. Geneva Overholser is professor at the Missouri School of Journalism. Lucy Dalgleish is executive director of the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. They both join us today from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us on the show. Lucy, can I ask you, first of all, do you say, as a matter of absolute principle, that under no circumstances should a reporter ever disclose the identity of a confidential source?
I think I agree with what Floyd just said, that, I would never say that there are absolutely no circumstances. However, I'd be hard-pressed to come up with a circumstance where a reporter should be compelled. And there are certainly journalists in Washington in particular who believe that were they to ever reveal the name of a confidential source, they'd essentially be sacrificing their career.
Geneva, what's your view on that?
Well, as a journalist among these lawyers who often save us journalists, I don't at all disagree. My concern, however, is that we use these difficult occasions, such as this one, to examine our journalistic practices and think more carefully about the use and, I think, overuse of anonymous sources. So that is certainly a topic that I would like to see us address. However, I don't accuse Matthew Cooper of having abused anonymous sources, and I respect him and Time magazine for wanting to follow this important principle.
Explain what you mean when you talk about the abuse and misuse of anonymous sources.
Well, Robin, I have a very powerful feeling that, particularly in Washington, we have come to a juncture where too many in the press rely on the use of anonymous sources almost routinely. Now, I don't think we have the luxury of absolutism here. It is clear that there are occasions when, unless we are willing to quote someone anonymously and afford them this protection of not revealing their identity, then we can't get important information to the public. Mm. But there are so many occasions short of that, short of the place where sources' jobs would be endangered or even lives would be endangered, where we simply accord this anonymity. I have heard reporters offer it up. And I think too often we journalists do our reporting, sometimes without due concern, and then expect the lawyers to save us afterwards. And I think in occasions such as this, we should recommit to taking care of our own ethical concerns in the first place.
Lucy, clearly, if reporters did not give some sources a guarantee of anonymity, then they would not get the stories, which sometimes they do. I mean, I've certainly many times in my career said to somebody, can you tell me X? They've said, no, I can't. And I've said, well, if I promised you anonymity, could you? And then sometimes they say yes, and sometimes they say no. Do you share Geneva's concern that sometimes reporters are too ready to offer anonymity?
Yes, I do. And I think there are very few reporters who would disagree with that. Of course, they all think that, of course, they're not one of the ones that offers it too easily. But Geneva's right. I mean, I get a lot of interview requests, and oftentimes they will offer to me, say, well, you can be off the record. And sometimes I say, that's all right, I'll say it on the record. Mm. You know? But I think it's very important to very carefully consider who you're going to offer anonymity to. There are some people, particularly in the current atmosphere in this country, where the government is turning so much information into secrets, information that used to be on the public record. We now have a lot of particularly federal employees who are going to journalists and giving them information saying, I really think the public needs to know this, but the only way I can you know, protect myself is if I tell it to you and you promise me confidentiality. We are entering a time when the more secrets that we're developing within the government, the more we're going to have to rely on whistleblowers and other people who are willing to risk their jobs and their livelihoods to do this. And I think we're going to be seeing more cases like this rather than less.
Let's take a call. Doug is in from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hello, Doug.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Well, do you have... Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I love the show. The case that I wanted to make was that I think in cases of privilege or in issues of privilege, you have to kind of take it on a case-by-case basis. And in this case, it's really hard for me to see what public interest is being served in keeping this secret. It seems like there really wasn't a story here to begin with, and I question why they had to publish the fact that this woman was a CIA operative. I think the more important story is who in the government exposed her, and that the public good would be more served by exposing the source. And I feel like when journalists publish this kind of information, they need to ask themselves, you know, are they helping, and is this really important story, or is this something I'm just publishing to try and sell papers and, you know, should be held to a higher standard?
Okay, Doug, thanks for that. Geneva, the particular case versus the general principle.
Well, Robin, I think there's no question that Doug has an important point here. This is particularly not the Matthew Cooper aspect of it, but I would argue the Robert Novak aspect of it.
Who originally disclosed
syndicated
this information.
Columnist, exactly. Yeah. He first disclosed this this case of naming the CIA operative. And it feels unsavory because we protect reporters to make it possible for reporters to disclose wrongdoing, not to enable reporters to help others commit wrongdoing, which to me is what, personally, I find it looked like when Novak did it. I have to say, though, we all know that you have to protect important principles no matter how unappealing the individual occurrence may be.
But just to be sorry to stop you, Geneva, but to be clear, if you were a writing journalist and a government official had volunteered that information to you, that the wife of a former ambassador who'd been engaged in this expedition to discover whether or not Iraq was trying to obtain nuclear weapons material and disclosed that the wife of that ambassador was a CIA operative, you would have regarded that as not interesting enough to publish?
Oh, no, I would have thought it very interesting, and I like to believe that I would have written a story saying a government official called me to out a CIA operative, which may very likely have been a felony. I'm talking with too many lawyers around me, but
yeah, right.
I like to believe I would have done that, but that's a very different story from enabling the government, whoever it was, senior administration officials, as Novak had characterized them, to smear someone.
However, okay, so you would not have given the name of that operative, that's
no,
what you're saying.
No, absolutely not.
I see,
I think to me, allowing anonymous quotes has all kinds of standards we have to apply. One of them is this important information. Was it important to know that Joe Wilson's wife suggested him? I mean, is this a revolutionary thing? We all suggest spouses for various things. I don't think it qualified.
We'll take a break. When we're back, should journalists have special legal protections about how to cooperate with grand jury investigations that other citizens don't? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the protections that journalists say they ought to have when it comes to disclosing anonymous sources. I would like to welcome now to the show Daniel Okrent, who is the New York Times' public editor. Daniel, thanks for giving us your time this morning. Can I just get from you your policy on when, if ever, reporters should disclose the identity of an anonymous source?
Well, I should begin by saying my policy and the New York Times policy are not necessarily the same.
Okay.
I operate independently of the paper. So which one do you want?
I want yours.
Personally, I believe that in ideal circumstances, and of course circumstances are never ideal, a reporter should reveal the name of a source when a source lies to the reporter. I believe that there is implicit contract and that reporters should make it explicit that they tell people, if this turns out to be a falsehood, I'm going to expose you. I think this is the sort of thing that could have prevented us from a lot of embarrassing news coverage in the build-up to the Iraq War, for instance.
Ah, okay. Before we come on to that, though, if the person doing the disclosing, by doing that, is committing a crime, does the reporter then have a responsibility, a citizen's responsibility, to bring that criminal to justice?
Well, first, what's the determination of the crime? At the time that I'm being told something that may or may not be against the law, and I think in the case that we're discussing, it is not clear precisely that it is against the law as written, when do you make that judgment? Do you make that judgment? I think that usually in the American system, we make judgments on crime after convictions. And in this case, and certainly in any case where a court is trying to get the information, the conviction always follows rather than precedes that judgment. So I think it's kind of creating a non-existent situation.
Okay. Now, you raise the interesting hypothesis of a source giving a journalist information which turns out to be false, and you put that in the context of the coverage before the Iraq War. Some listeners will have seen the Washington Post this morning, which runs a very detailed critique, not unlike that which was run by the New York Times, looking back over their record. The use of anonymous sources gets reporters into trouble, doesn't it?
It gets reporters, newspapers, television stations, and mostly it gets readers into trouble. It's a really bad thing. But like many bad things, it is often a necessary thing. The problem with the largest problem with anonymous sources is we don't know their motivation, and the readers are not in a position to judge their motivation. The same information, I believe that much of the information in the walk-up to the Iraq War that was attached to anonymous sources, had readers known who those sources were, I think that there would have been a very different feeling in this country about whether the war was appropriate or not.
That places a responsibility on the reporter, even when they are given information by a source who insists on anonymity, in making a judgment about motivation and, I suppose, also about reliability.
It's absolutely necessary, and I worry that in many cases, because reporters are generally trained to say, well, if we cite a fact, we are attributing it to somebody. We're not saying that we believe it. We're saying somebody else believes it. Well, when you remove the attribution and simply say it's a high administration source or rankings senior Defense Department official, you have lost the underpinning of that argument entirely. So there's more of an obligation, I believe, a much greater obligation for reporters and their editors to go with unattributed material only when there is reason, truly strong reason to believe that it's true.
Lucy, do you worry about the motivation of whistleblowers sometimes?
Do I worry about it?
No, I wanted to go to Lucy Dalgleish.
I'm sorry.
Obviously, whistleblowers have some sort of motivation, and I think it's always a journalist's responsibility to consider what motivations their sources might have. But I don't think that that is an issue that most journalists would take lightly. They think about it very carefully.
But if I might add here,
yes, Robin, Geneva,
yeah. It seems to me that we should not only as journalists worry about motivation, but share what we know about motivation with readers. As Daniel was saying, it's readers who in the end are bereft of the information they need. And I think often if we were to share the information we have, and if we were to ask ourselves to do that, we wouldn't, in fact, go on and use it. I mean, what if, for example, in the Novak case, he had said two senior administration officials with an intent to discredit Joe Wilson, which, if you ask me, was the intent.
Yeah, probably was.
Okay. Let's hear from Larry, who's on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Larry, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
So my comment is just... Should we be affording reporters special hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just don't think absolutely not. They shouldn't be afforded any special special legal rights, because what happens then is that the public loses accountability in the reporting. Now, take for example what happened with the BBC and Andrew Gilligan. Here's a case where there was, you know, an anonymous source being quoted, because he felt maybe he could keep the source quiet, he misattributed the quote. He says that it was a senior defense.
Okay, well, Larry, I don't want to go too deeply into that because I could bore you for the rest of the day on that particular subject. But the point that you make is a good one about the legal protection which journalists are entitled to expect. Daniel, can I come back to you on that? Do you believe that reporters do need more legal protection than the First Amendment gives them now?
Well, I think we're going to be finding out in the Cooper case how much protection the First Amendment does give them. So I wouldn't want to judge what.
But it's certainly pretty fuzzy at the moment.
I do believe that the legal protection is a necessity, and I think that what Larry from Cambridge is saying, is, in my experience, is most often represented by people who are displeased with the information that the reporter has let out. But if it's information that you wish to have out, that let us say you were against the war in Iraq, and a reporter has inside information that he's not attributing that says that Rumsfeld consciously lied for 6 months about it, then a lot of people would say, well, yes, let's protect that reporter. You can't apply it based on whether you agree with what the value of the information
right.
is.
Right. But
you know, let's talk.
Yeah.
Can we talk for a second about what the purpose of a privilege is?
Sure.
I mean, just journalists take their that what they believe to be their privilege to keep sources confidential just as seriously as doctors and lawyers and clergymen. And the reason that the law affords those people an absolute privilege is because society wants to encourage people to speak to those who can help them. And we believe there is a societal good that comes about by letting an individual talk to a lawyer.
But there is one big difference, isn't there, between reporters and those people you mentioned, doctors, lawyers, and clergymen, which is that the professions, they have professional bodies who act as a kind of disciplinary board if they are considered to overstep the mark.
Not in the case of clergy, they usually don't.
Well, okay, but doctors and lawyers certainly do.
And
reporters don't.
And
reporters, traditionally, we've always rejected any idea that there should be such a thing, any way to license reporters.
Yes, but the whole idea of the privilege is to encourage people to speak comfortably to a reporter so that ultimately the truth will come out. And on balance, I think a privilege is much better and the public is much better off because they're getting a free flow of information than they would be if journalists had no privilege to keep those sources confidential.
And there, Daniel Okrand, I suspect we come close to why this is of interest or should be of interest to more than just those of us who are in the business, because there is a degree to which if these things are not guaranteed, then the public do not get the kind of information which they think they're entitled to get.
Without privilege, and I think that even more importantly, without the day-to-day anonymity that is granted whistleblowers, no one would blow the whistle.
Okay, let's hear from Sandro, who's in Hamilton in Canada. Sandro, hello.
Yes, I'm enjoying your show. Thank you.
Good, thanks.
It seems to me as if the administration, with this small maneuver, has played the press like a fiddle once again, brilliantly, and also guarded its side by knowing full well that the press would never divulge the identity of this the person who gave this name out. Point number two would be also that by protecting this source, the administration is also protecting its argument for going to war, thereby gaining a daily double, if you will.
Okay, thanks, Sandro. Lucy, I want to come back to this thing about the motivation of whistleblowers, because it seems to me it could be quite dangerous if reporters say, before I use any information that comes to me from a confidential source, I'm going to ask myself, why have I been told this? Is there a political agenda here? Because the reporter then starts making judgments which aren't really journalistic judgments, perhaps.
Well, I think the thing, you have to be conscious of what the motivations are. And if it's necessary to also report what the motivations might be, and if that gives the public a better picture of what's really going on, I think that's probably the way you should handle it.
Mm. Yeah, I don't agree really, Robin, that it's not a journalistic judgment. Who, what, when, where, why, how. I mean, it makes a difference. We have to care why people are telling us things, and we have to share that with the readers or viewers or listeners.
But I mean, we all know that sometimes when people tell us things that they shouldn't tell us because of the kind of job that they're doing, their motives may not be terribly noble, but it's still information which is valuable to get out there in public.
You know, absolutely, but it's also important to get the information about how why they're doing it in, if we possibly can.
You know, 20 years ago, there was an infamous case in the newsroom that I used to work in, and I was there that day. It was when, before an election in Minnesota, an operative for one of the parties gave some off-the-record information to four different reporters, and the two newsrooms, because it was so close to the election, the reporters made the promise. The editors countermanded that promise and said, no, it's so close to the election. The motivation here is obviously a dirty campaign trick. Identify the source. Well, what happens then? The source sues. The case goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The jury said, you know, they were told by the expert witnesses, reporters are supposed to keep their promises. They're not supposed to identify their confidential sources. And the jury bought that. And the newspapers ended up paying well over $500,000 in costs and compensation to the source who was identified. And he was compensated because once he was identified, his employer fired him.
It's interesting. I mean, Daniel Okrent, if a case of this kind were to come before a jury, how confident would you be that they would take the side of the reporter and agree with the profession's view that protecting the identity of a source must be the paramount consideration?
Well, there are many other considerations that would come into whether you could make the persuasive argument or not. But I would fear that in the current climate where the press has lost so much credibility, that if there's such a thing as an average or typical jury, it would be very, very hard to persuade that jury to give the privilege.
And the loss of that credibility, you think, is a direct result of the coverage leading up to the Iraq War?
Well, that's one in many years of press misdeeds. The press is held in very, very low esteem for very, very good reason. The press has been wrong about a lot of things and has gone, we've overstepped our bounds too often, and we're paying the price for it now.
What do you
been a lot of unfair criticisms of the press, I would add to that, Daniel, that
we
shouldn't.
But I think it's important, Geneva, that we don't run away from those which are fair criticisms.
What do you make, Daniel, of Floyd Abrahams and indeed other people's argument that lawyers aren't expected to disclose what they are told in confidence by their clients? Doctors, as we know, are not required to disclose what their patients tell them in confidence. Reporters ought to have some similar protection.
I believe they should have the protection, but not for those reasons. I think they're very different situations, because where is the harm? The private conversation between a doctor and a patient, there's no one else who is at risk because of that. But there is a great deal that can be at risk when reporters are speaking to anonymous sources. I believe that they should have the privilege because a free press needs anonymous sources, needs whistleblowers to be able to come forward. I wouldn't make the comparison to the other professions.
Okay, we'll take another call. Carl is in from Norfolk, Virginia. Hello, Carl.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you. What do you think about all this?
We have some feedback, so I'm having difficulty in hearing you.
Oh, dear. Can you give it a go?
I guess part of my concern, and I've heard it from Lucy and many others, is what happens to the traditional Fourth Estate, which was protected and as such gave us valuable information? Yeah, I get the feeling that this case is different from the one in Minnesota, and I'm old enough to remember that. This is more politically driven than data-driven.
All right, let's see what Daniel Okrent thinks about that. I mean, Daniel, you were talking about the climate and the loss of credibility that the press has. Do you see political motivations in cases of this kind now?
Oh, often. I think many such cases, and I won't say that this one specifically is politically motivated, but there are people in prosecutorial positions who have a reason to want to get back at the press, to punish the press or to limit the press. I think that's almost always political.
Lucy?
Yes, absolutely.
And is there a real risk that could happen, that reporters could feel that they do not have the kind of legal protection that they feel they might need and therefore
My experience with dealing with reporters is they don't really care all that much whether or not they have legal protection.
Right.
In their mind, You know, they make a promise, they're going to keep the promise. They don't care what the law says. If the court says, you know, Mr. Reporter, you don't have a privilege, then the reporter will go to jail. I mean, we have several dozen reporters over the last 20 years who have gone to jail under circumstances like this. Perhaps not in a story as high profile as this, but reporters do go to jail with quite alarming frequency.
Well, I hope we're going to be able to talk to one of them, in fact, very soon in this show. Daniel, you wanted to come back on that?
No, I think.
Okay. But Geneva, do you believe that reporters do sometimes sit there at their desk, having had a phone call with somebody who insists on remaining anonymous, and they say to themselves, I want to publish this, I think the public have a right to know this, but there's a risk I could go to jail?
I really don't think that happens very often. Mm. I don't want to sound overly glorified about this, but I really believe that reporters, by and large, feel that if information comes their way, they need to get it to the public. And I think one of the problems in this debate is that we refer to this as a reporter's privilege. Really, in the end, it's a public privilege. Mm-hmm. It's the public's ability to get information. And I think it's important to hold on to that, because it's easy for many in the public to say, well, why should the reporters be protected? The answer is, on the public behalf.
The problem, though, is, I suspect, that the public perhaps have less confidence in why reporters are writing certain things, even in the reliability of what they're writing. A lot of people think reporters just want glory.
Or they think that reporters are simply making things up. Mm-hmm. And the bad news is that too many reporters make things up, and we are paying the price for that right now.
Geneva,
I really don't think many reporters make things up. I think many reporters allow themselves to be used, and I do think the public is concerned about that.
But we have to accept, don't we, that every reporter likes being on the front page. They like getting a big story. It looks good. It does them good. It feels good. And sometimes they push things.
Yeah, I agree with Geneva. I overstated that. But what I'm referring to is that the very, very high-profile cases in recent years at USA Today and at the New York Times particularly, demonstrate that the untrammeled faith in the integrity of reporters needs to be trammeled a bit.
Okay, Daniel, I want to thank you for coming onto the show today. Daniel Okrent, New York Times public editor. We're talking about reporters' rights, reporters' responsibilities. Do they have a First Amendment protection which guarantees them the right to retain the confidentiality of their sources? We're going to take a break. You can join us when we're back. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about reporters' rights, reporters' responsibilities, and guaranteeing the confidentiality of their sources. My guests are Geneva Overholser, professor at the Missouri School of Journalism, Lucy Dalgleish, executive director of the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press. And I'd like to welcome this segment of the programme, Vanessa Leggett, who's a writer in Houston, who spent nearly 6 months in jail in 2001. For refusing to disclose her sources to federal investigators. Vanessa, welcome to the programme.
Thanks.
You refused, point blank, to disclose a source and you went to jail. Why didn't you do what they wanted you to do?
Well, they were wanting me to reveal confidential source material, and I'd promised my sources confidentiality, and I wasn't going to breach that.
That was more important to you than your freedom?
Yeah, because of the implications and what cost it would have cost the American public, really, had I disclosed those sources, because in the future, sources would refuse to talk, potentially. And once my situation was addressed in the media, that makes everyone aware that their ability to trust the media might be in jeopardy.
So what do you think, as you hear about, read about Matthew Cooper's case and the current investigation, the threat that he might go to jail, do you identify with him?
Oh, yes, most definitely.
And if you were in his shoes, you would refuse to disclose your source?
Absolutely, and I think he will too.
How about Robert Novak, the syndicated columnist, who in fact was the first person to disclose this particular piece of information. Do you think that he, that Matthew Cooper, that others should have asked themselves why they were being told what they were being told?
Yeah, I think so. But the point is that that's really water under the bridge at this point. It can't be undone. Right now, the press needs to just focus on maintaining the confidentiality of their sources and not caving into the government.
But there is a principle, isn't there? I mean, we've already been talking about why reporters do insist on not disclosing the identity of sources, and indeed why sources insist on not being identified. Did you not at any point think that maybe you could identify your source without the kind of negative results that you feared?
No, I really didn't. And I really felt I had a duty, you know, to my sources and really to the public, more importantly. I've been asked if some of my sources said it's okay for you to go ahead and disclose our identity. Go ahead and do that. I still wouldn't do it because the public's perception is that they could be compromised.
Even if the source had said that they were prepared to release you from your guarantee of confidentiality, you wouldn't have taken that way out?
Well, you know, I think if it was made abundantly clear in the media that the source had released me, perhaps, but my gut just tells me that I wouldn't.
This became a very personal matter, for obvious reasons, to you. The night before you went to jail, did you not just sit there at home and think, is there no other way I could handle this? Is there no way I could avoid doing this?
Well, I pretty much, you know, thought of that as much as I could have, and I contacted the Reporters Committee, and they sort of walked me through it, and I really thought that my options were, you know, either go to jail or give up my sources, and there really wasn't any way around that. Unfortunately, in my case, the government was not willing to alter their subpoena, and the subpoena that I was issued was ridiculous, really. I mean, it asked for all of my research material. It wasn't specific in the material it was seeking. They wanted my complete research archives from 4 years' worth of research in as many states, and they wouldn't even allow me to keep a copy. They wanted any and all originals and copies in my possession, and the government was not even going to allow me to keep a copy of any of my interviews, and to me, that was just an obvious sign that there was something wrong.
Now, some reporters say that this is a price that reporters must be prepared to pay. Others say there ought to be a more clear-cut legal protection which would guarantee that people did not have to run the risk that you ran and go to jail as you did. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's... I hesitate to say that we should have some law in place because I don't know if reporters' rights will be even further abridged than they are now. But I do think that the press can stay resolute, and they really have the power to decide to uphold this duty to their sources and the public. And if it means sacrificing their freedom, that's just, you know, a job risk.
Okay, Vanessa, let me just take a call. Richard on the line from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Richard, what do you think?
Well, my question is kind of a hypothetical, really. What mechanism is it to prevent a journalist from putting something that they created fictionally in an article and then attributing it to an unnamed source and then refusing, of course, to reveal that unnamed source?
Okay. Lucy, I guess the short answer to that is the editor.
The editor, and I think we have a lot of operations in newsrooms and everything. We operate a lot on faith, and I think that is that a hypothetical risk? Sure it is. Do I think that that actually happens on a routine basis? Absolutely not.
But it does happen. We know it happens. We've
seen
cases.
We know it has happened. We know it's happened in the last couple of years, and we also know that those news organizations have taken some pretty substantial hits. They have gone out to investigate. They have been very public about how they handled it. And I think they have been receptive and honorable in the way that they have handled the aftermath of those two, particularly the USA Today and New York Times cases. Can we always protect against that happening? Of course not. But as we see with this, I think these people always get found out.
You know, Richard raises a terribly important point, but the fact is if you look at what the New York Times and USA Today did and compare it, say, to what companies like Enron have done in their wrongdoing, I think we can take heart that the public can see there is some increasing transparency on the part of the media. I also want to say that it seems to me that we ought to ask the public, and maybe one of the good things about this difficult case and Vanessa's bravery too, is that these are occasions when the public can become more aware of what would be the danger if we didn't have proscriptions against the governments simply using the press as another information gathering arm.
And how would that work?
Well, that's exactly what can happen if the courts can simply summon reporters in and ask, as they ask Vanessa, for all of her notes.
We refer to that as being agents of discovery. Yeah. In other words, they are looking to investigate a civil case or a criminal case, and the obvious, easy way to go and get that information if you're trying to prosecute a case is to go to a reporter. And that really compromises the independence of the journalist, and it puts the journalist in the position of being an agent for the government.
But we get into some very difficult territory, don't we? Because if it is in the public interest that wrongdoing should first be exposed and then dealt with, that wrongdoers should be punished, then reporters are citizens in the same way as everybody else. They have a duty to help the properly constituted legal authorities to deal with whatever the case might be.
But a reporter's duty is to report the information. I mean, the idea that
it stops there?
Well, no, it does. In many respects, it does. If a reporter finds out that a crime has been committed, the reporter's duty is to report that something happened. It's not the reporter's duty to prosecute the crime or be an agent of the government in the investigation. The notion that a reporter would get the story of a lifetime and not report it is, you know, pretty preposterous. So the reporter's job is to get information, publish it, and let other people in society who have a role in that particular story do their jobs.
But Geneva, I know of cases in England, certainly, I don't know about in this country, where newspapers have reported a case of public corruption or of a crime being committed, and the day after publication of the story, they hand over their material to the police.
I must say, in the UK, Robin, the law is significantly different from the law here.
I know. But is that not how a reporter should behave?
No, I guess, you know, when you make a statement that reporters are no different from the public, there is a very important difference. They are privileged to have the ability to bring to the public the information it needs to govern itself. It's much harder for the average citizen to do that. And citizens know that reporters can do that. There are famous cases in which people have taken important information to reporters, and they, the people, the whistleblowers, have been protected, and the nation has been better off. I mean, that's a significant difference.
You know, the report journalism or the press is the only entity mentioned in the Constitution. It's the only craft, profession, trade that you want to talk to that is specifically mentioned in the Constitution as having protections from government interference.
Let's just hear from Doug, who's in Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm really missing the whole point here is that, I mean, reporters should be able to keep their sources secret, but if a reporter themselves breaks the law, which in this case Mr. Novak did by disclosing a CIA operative, then he himself should be prosecuted, not his source. That's an incidental.
You know,
he himself has broken the law, correct?
No, I'm afraid that's incorrect. The law, that particular statute, when it was passed 10 or 15 years ago, has specific provisions, and there were specific conversations in Congress, and the media would not be responsible for publishing information like that. That's an incorrect assumption that Mr. Novak broke the law.
You're saying that the law specifically excludes journalists from disclosing a CIA agent's name.
The law applies to government officials who have received that information and then disclosed the information. It does not apply to journalists or you.
Doug, do you think that's probably the way it should be, that reporters should have the right to disclose things?
Well, I mean, if a journalist goes in, for instance, on a break-in with a thief as part of writing a story about people who break into houses, he himself has, even though he's with someone else, he's writing a story, he himself has broken a law by entering someone else's property without their knowledge with another thief. Shouldn't that be prosecuted just like anybody else?
No, because what I'm saying is the particular statute that we're talking about here, would Mr. Novak, unless somebody completely, you know, I really don't think they're going to be going after Mr. Novak as having broken the law.
Now, we find ourselves in this situation where we have a reporter, Matthew Cooper of Time magazine, facing a contempt hearing, the possibility of going to jail. This is obviously going to go way up through the court system. At the end of that process, Geneva, do you think we may see at least a clarification of the law and perhaps a strengthening of reporters' rights to do what they believe they need to do?
I quaken my boots over what we will see because it's such an open question. I think it would be wonderful if we did see this strengthening. I think it is possible that the public will understand more in the course of all this about its need to have reporters be strengthened in their ability to gather information, including from anonymous sources. But I can't say I feel terribly optimistic.
You don't sound very optimistic.
No,
Lucy, how about you?
I pretty much agree with Geneva. I mean, I really hope the public uses this as another opportunity to understand how confidential sources work and understand how journalism works. But I have a feeling that for the first time in a very long time, probably 35 years, we are going to see a fairly substantial confrontation over reporters' privilege issues that will probably end up in the Supreme Court.
And for those people who believe they have information either in government or in other places which the public has a right to know, they want to be a whistleblower, can they still be confident that if they contact a reporter, that reporter will preserve their anonymity?
Absolutely.
Geneva?
Absolutely. They'll go to jail. I think Matthew Cooper probably will, and I admire him for it.
Well, my thanks to both of you, to Lucy Dalgleish from the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, to Professor Geneva Overholser of the Missouri School of Journalism. We also spoke to Vanessa Leggett, the Houston writer who went to jail for protecting her source, and to the First Amendment attorney Floyd Abrams, and to Daniel Okrent, the public editor of the New York Times. The Connection is produced by Nancy Cohen, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Matson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our interns are Micah Sieber and Nadia Usayev. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection.